Welcome everyone to Studying Pixels, your favorite game studies and video game culture podcast. This time around, we're going to talk about learning Japanese with video games, and that's why we thought, why don't we do our intro in Japanese? And this is how it goes. Minasan, konnichiwa. Game kenkyu toka game bunka nitsuite Studying Pixels podcast を聞いています。ドイツからゲーム研究学者ステファン・シーモンです。
テキサスから日本語学者ダン・ヒューズです。
そして毎週の日曜日にすべてポッドカーストアプリで放送しています。じゃあ始めましょうか。
よし
よし始めましょう。 And that would mean, well, shall we get started?じゃあ始めましょうか。 And we shall. Let's do it, because we've got a whole lot on our program for today. But before we jump into the actual subject, we want to briefly address an item of housekeeping, because we are very much looking to expand our team. Yes, for all of you out there, we are looking for some Instagram support. I don't know whether you've noticed that, but if you visit our Instagram account, our Instagram channel, then you might realize...it's not all that fancy. Like, we promote our weekly episodes on there, and we have these tiny short clips, and I try to do my best, but I don't have such a profound understanding of Instagram as many of you out there might have. So we're looking for someone who would be curious to join the Studying Pixels team, like become a proper part of the team in order to build up a Studying Pixels Instagram channel. And that should not just be...simply promoting the weekly podcast episodes, because yes, that's cool and that's a part of it, but it should be more than that. So you should be curious to want to create some native Instagram content on game studies and video game culture. Build a proper Studying Pixels Instagram page. We would really love to hear from you. We have to say, for the sake of transparency, that this is not a paid gig, because we all don't get paid on Studying Pixels. At the moment, we are still working on covering our own spendings when it comes to the project, our regular outgoings. So that's why, in all fairness and with all transparency, we can't pay you, at least at the moment. This is a mere passion project. But if you are curious still and you want to join us, then go to studyingpixels.com/contact.That is studyingpixels.com/contact to reach out. We'd be very happy to hear from you.
And you'd get to work with Pixelkun, which is kind of a reward in and of itself. At least I do say so myself.
Yes, a pixel hug is what you can get.
That's currently what we're being paid in.
That's what we're being paid in, pixel hugs. But hey, if you want to help us, everyone out there, in, you know...paying people that are on the team, maybe even reimbursing our spendings for this project and covering the expenses, then you can, of course, become a Studying Pixels Plus member. You will get a lovely I Am Studying Pixels sticker that you can put wherever you like. Throughout the last week, I actually saw a couple of tweets, people tweeting out that they received the sticker and putting it on their laptops and so on. It's like...It's pretty cool, I must say. It's a very wonderful feeling.
It was very cool. And I see that I'm not alone in marking down the value of my laptop with stickers. Although, as you said, Stefan, perhaps marking the value up somehow.
That will all depend on how much Pixelkun will be worth as an NFT in the future. But anyway, what you also get if you become a member of Studying Pixels Plus...is a monthly bonus episode that we do exclusively for Studying Pixels Plus members. And for this month, for January 2022, we're doing an episode titled 10 Tips to Nail Your Next Presentation, because we want to help you when it comes to presenting properly in a seminar or at any kind of other occasion where you'd have to do a presentation. And I can at least say that these 10 tips...They're not all obvious. There are some obvious ones in there, but not all of them are obvious. And I think it's well worth just taking the time to look into how to improve one's presentation game, considering how many presentations you might do throughout your life.
Especially if you're a particularly nervous public speaker, I think we address really well how to prepare, how to present, and how to kind of get over those jitters a little bit.
So if you want to hear that, then you can get Studying Pixels Plus by going to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more. In our main story today, we're going to talk about learning Japanese with video games. Because one of the most common reasons that people give when they say why they want to learn Japanese is enjoying Japanese media, manga, anime, and of course, video games in their original language. However, as many of you know, language acquisition is a long and sometimes tedious journey. Luckily, though, there are a whole lot of resources out there that can help you in doing that journey. The YouTube channel Game Gengo, so Game Gengo, is one of them. It is a channel that enjoys great popularity with nearly 12,000 subscribers today. And on his channel, Matt goes through popular Japanese video games, such as Final Fantasy VII Remake, Animal Crossing New Horizons, or Persona 5, and he goes through them step by step, explaining grammar and meaning. He's got lots of supplementary material and extensive videos on grammar, on verbs, on terminology, on kanji especially. So much supplementary material that people can follow along and improve their Japanese comprehension while at the same time enjoying their favorite video games. So who else would be a better guest for this topic to talk about how to learn Japanese with video games? I'm very glad that he is now joining us from Kyoto. Hi, Matt. Good to have you here.
Hello. Hey, guys.
You obviously connect two things very closely together. That is video games, Japanese video games, and the Japanese language, studying and teaching Japanese. But which of these interests in your biography came first? Were you first involved with JRPGs and Japanese video games in general, or with the Japanese language?
My passion was definitely video games first and foremost. It was one of the first things I ever did as a human being was immerse myself in video games back in the old... I started with like a Commodore 64, if you guys know what that is, like really old school. I used to love playing like Gremlins and The Labyrinth on like old school typing adventure games. I think the first video game that came from Japan that I really got into was Street Fighter, Sonic, and later Final Fantasy. So definitely video games came first before my love for Japanese.
That's very similar with me. And I find that when people ask me, all right, Dan, why Japanese? My go-to answer is, well, video games mostly.
Yeah,
it's kind of what kicked me off.
I find that interesting because when I joined my first Japanese course, I think the most common reasons for why people started studying Japanese were either manga, anime, or video games.
Mm.
And sometimes I encountered a little bit of saltiness when it comes to that, like as if it's a little bit of like an inferior reason to study a language that you just want to play. You want to play Final Fantasy in its original language, for example, like as if that is not a proper motivation. What would you say to that, Matt? Obviously, you wouldn't agree, I assume.
No. But I understand where it comes from, right? You have people who originally education was a very stiff textbook lecture type field, right? And you had that and self-study. And anything else, especially even just video games and manga by themselves, haven't been accepted mainstream until really recently, right? So it's only been quite recent that people are watching anime and playing video games has become quite normalized. In Japan, it's a little bit more normalized, but still it holds a little bit of a stigma, right? So I understand where it comes from, where people think that it's an inferior reason. But when you start going down that road where you're judging other people's reasons for enjoying something, it's just, it's negative and it's not necessary, right? Like if you have a passion, then you should, you know, feel free to go all into it as much as you want. Right?
In my experience too, when talking to Japanese people, if I tell them, oh, I got interested because of culture largely, that's not like that's not a thing that gets poo-pooed or anything. It's like, oh, cool. You like that?
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you like Japanese culture. Yeah. Oh, cool. Video games.
Yeah. Yep. But I think language acquisition is such a... It's a long and tedious road to get to a level where you can properly communicate in a language, right? It takes a lot of time and effort.
Absolutely.
And while I do think that is not to be underestimated, I would say it's even better than if you have a strong passion, a strong motivating factor behind that learning process.
Absolutely, yes. For me, learning Japanese it wasn't the most enjoyable experience. It was, and I really wanted to make it a more enjoyable experience. What I always kind of dreamed that it could be, trying to make it a little bit more fun, right? Connecting fun with education. And not in the way of gamification, but more in, as you said, studying a language takes a lot of time and it's a huge investment, okay? Like, I've been doing it for 10 years and it's still not, I'm not finished, right? Like, it keeps on going. So you don't want to be stuck with textbooks and Anki flashcards for 10 years. That sounds like a horrible, horrible existence. So finding things that help motivate you keep it up is incredibly important, whether that be TV shows, anime, making friends, or video games, whatever it is.
And at the same time, I think it is also very important to put things a little bit into perspective, in that when I thought, cool, I'm going to study Japanese because I would like to play some video games in Japanese, I quickly realized it's not that simple. It takes a long time before you get to a point that you can enjoy playing video games in Japanese. And right. Your channel helps with that. But how do you even do that? Because you have a lot to learn before you can, I would say, comfortably jump into your first video game in Japanese.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of like hard mode, if you think about it, because it's very much like throwing you into the deep end and being like, okay, swim. But the good thing is that you have that motivation and that interest, right? When you're reading a piece of text that you have no connection to, I couldn't imagine something more boring, right? That you can't have a connection to the language. But even as a complete beginner, complete day one beginner, if you try and read a piece of text that maybe you're familiar with from a video game and you can unlock it and you go, oh my God, that word, oh, and make that connection with that scene or that character or whatever, that's going to leave a much stronger impression, in my opinion. So for me, with creating a channel based around learning video games, learning Japanese through video games, I'm thinking about how to be educational and also how not to be too heavy on that education, but enough so that it's kind of like a bridge between where you, who may not necessarily understand everything, I can help bridge those gaps and just make the transition easier for you with a kind of underlining philosophy of, well, if you do this enough, you will eventually wake up one day and be like, hey, I can do this, right? Because you will have seen the basic things enough that you will have picked up those building blocks and you'll get to that point where it's just the same as any other language learner at an advanced level where you just getting new language, but the foundation has been learned.
When I was at university, it was kind of looked down upon, where it was like, oh, manga, like there's the manga, anime, video game people who are in this class for that reason.
Right.
But I remember a professor of mine said, you know, Japan's literacy rate is so high because people read manga and it's less complicated than really difficult texts. And so there's nothing wrong with using that as an entry point, because a lot of Japanese people do that too. And so I think that video games, especially if you have that connection, it can be really motivating to keep going with the language study. And I want to ask, you mentioned kind of the like, oh, I got it, like the eureka moment. Do you have a moment that comes to mind for you where you started realizing like, oh, wow, I'm picking this up in video games as well as in my classes?
I have several moments, because I jumped around, because when you start off as a complete beginner without any assistance, obviously it's very overwhelming. I used to spend something like 30 minutes on like a line of dialogue and go through it. But I think for me, Final Fantasy VII was definitely the big one, because I knew the game so well growing up. I played that game more than anything else. Final Fantasy VIII as well, I played a lot. But Final Fantasy VII, I played so much. So then playing it in Japanese, the whole experience of going through that game was like a nostalgic experience of re-experiencing those childhood memories, but also seeing it in a new way and a kind of the way it was intended originally. So you go, whoa, this is what the character's personality was actually like. Whoa, this is what they actually said, whoa, oh my God. And all of this interaction with the characters, I wouldn't have been able to experience that if I hadn't tried to do it in Japanese. Reading a translation of that later would have been a much more boring thing to do. So actually doing it yourself is a really unique and special experience. I can't think of a pinpoint time, but I think just a lot of the first games like Final Fantasy VII Dragon Quest IX, things like that. Yeah.
Do you feel like it is kind of like you're getting the keys to the kingdom a little bit, where you said like, oh, that character, that's actually how he's characterized, or that's what he's saying at this point. It is cool to have those moments.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that, by the very nature of game localization, you cannot experience through localization. Because if you do a direct translation, in the translation world, you would be considered a bad translator, because you're not supposed to be translating one for one everything they say, which that means you have to take liberties. You have to take creative changes. And sometimes, like what happened recently with a lot of games, but particularly Final Fantasy VII Remake, where people were very confused with what happened in the game because of those changes, being able to do that in Japanese is such a, yeah, it's like getting the key to unlock, you know, the truth. It's kind of like, oh, wow, that's what happened. Oh.
I had that very experience when I played Animal Crossing. I played it in English at first, and then I switched to Japanese because I felt like I was at a level that I could at least give it a shot. It was, by the way, still too early at that time, I realized, right, shortly thereafter. But yes, then I realized all the nuances that are, or the permeating meanings and characterizations within the utterances of characters that are in some form translated in the English version, but they just have a different vibe. It has a different feel to them. Like the same sentence in Japanese can tell you a different thing about who this character is supposed to be and what relation they are to you.
I think Animal Crossing is a really good example of that because of the mannerisms that they have and the little pieces of language that are used to actually show their characteristics and, you know, who they are, how they speak, and things like that. I think that's a really good example of showing that off, yeah.
But I'm wondering, if I were to be a complete beginner and mm-hmm. I wanted to jump into a video game to play it in Japanese,
yep,
which kind of attributes should I watch out for? Because I can imagine that some video games are more easily accessible and others are much harder. For example, Final Fantasy VII Remake would probably completely overwhelm me at this point because of the technicality of the language, because it flows in real time and these kinds of things.
The Nomura-isms.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What is it that you would watch out for? Which kind of criteria should a game fulfill for someone who's at a beginner stage and would like to say, I think I would like to try it at least and jump into a game?
Obviously, my number one recommendation is find a game that you enjoy, something that you're genuinely interested in. That's going to give you the motivation to power through it no matter what difficulty. However, for beginners, if you're wanting the most helpful attributes to a game that's going to help you learn, I would say you want to have a game that, number one, has furigana. That is just, without a doubt, the most helpful thing to have. Press to continue is another really important thing. Just as you said, if you try and play a game like Final Fantasy VII Remake, even if it had furigana, it flies by so quickly. Having a game that you can press to continue to the next scene and take the language at your own pace, that's a really important thing. And then the next important thing that I would say is voice acting. Just because it's tough playing a game that doesn't have voice acting. You need to be in control of your own motivational factors. But if you have voice acting, I think it's really, it keeps your attention, it keeps you interested, and it keeps you listening to real Japanese. So even if you miss something, you're still getting some practice in the process. So if you can have those three things, then in my view, you have a perfect learning game.
How is it for you, Dan? Because I know that you played a lot of games in Japanese, and you do play a lot of them in Japanese. Do you have a specific game that you would recommend to people? I'm just asking you because you're also like super experienced in that regard.
I know like a recent game, the game that I always point to, I don't know that I would recommend it, but it does help that there's Disney characters in it. And so it's kind of aimed at children, is Kingdom Hearts.
Okay.
I would say that I recently played Ni no Kuni, which also felt very kind of introductory. I just agree with everything that Matt said, especially the voice acting, because one thing that you don't really learn without speaking to somebody in Japanese is how it's supposed to sound. And it is so discreet sometimes with inflection and different ways to pronounce certain words or how to end certain sentences in a way that makes makes it a question or makes it sort of a don't you agree with me kind of sentence, that it really does help to actually hear people talk and hear how people might realistically speak.
Absolutely. And I think it's a thing that actually helps the counter argument that we started this conversation with, talking about, well, video games are bad for learning because you'll learn all this bad mannerisms and you'll learn all these bad things. Well, if you have voice acting, it will actually help you fix and correct those mistakes that you may make if you're reading it on your own. Because even today, I was helping someone in Discord with playing a game in Japanese, and I could hear them reading the sentences out loud, and I was like, it's not quite that way. You want to say it a little bit differently. If you had voice acting, I wouldn't need to do that. They'd be able to hear it and be like, oh, it's not said this way. So it can actually help almost prevent bad habits and things like that if you have voice acting. So really, really important.
When I think about these criteria and my experiences from playing now a couple of games in Japanese, I would say visual novels are something that I found really helpful, especially that there are some visual novels where you can switch the language on the fly. Visual novels where you can usually like rewind, or you can play the audio, the voice acting again of certain lines. That can be really helpful. And one thing that I discovered just recently and that I found pretty neat is that in Pokemon Sword and Shield, while it does not have any voice acting, it does allow you to select whether you want a full kana script that just consists of katakana and hiragana, or whether you want a kanji script, which is, I personally would always go for the kanji script because I think it's easier to read, actually. Yeah. Otherwise, just have this like clump together kana.
Yeah.
But I think for someone who's at an early beginner stage, this can be super helpful, especially to flick back and forth in order to just see, okay, what's the reading of this kanji?
Yeah. And Pokemon has some other advantages as well, such as the spacing that they have. They're really nice with the spacing. So you can see this bit is in its own little bit. This adjective is modifying this noun, and then it's spaced, and then this bit is connected. So rather than this big, long stream of unseparable Japanese that confuses you, Pokemon does help you with that, the spacing as well.
I don't mean this to sound, you know, like I'm talking down to anyone, but it really is like the first manga that my Japanese teacher ever gave to me was the first Dragon Ball, because it's meant for kids. And so the vocabulary that you're going to learn and the grammar structures that you see, it's like you're saying, the spacing is really important because it's meant for a younger audience. So not that you listeners are a younger audience, but you are coming in at a level similar to a younger audience, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah, and so it can really help.
So it definitely is helpful, but there are some kind of false friends, I suppose you could say, with the Pokemon series and other things like that. Slang is something that can really, and dialect can really get in the way of your understanding. Pokemon actually has quite a lot of that. Characters speak in very, very strong personalities, right? So it's not always standard Japanese. So it can get quite difficult. And Ni No Kuni also falls into the same trap, where Ni No Kuni is a fantastic game. It's great. It's got furigana, voice acting, wonderful. But your best friend talks in an Osaka dialect, which is very, very difficult to understand. And then everyone talks in slang or fantasy speech. So it can make it sometimes a little bit difficult. Not to say it's bad, but just there are certain challenges to certain games that you need to watch out for. Yeah.
Well, I feel compelled to tell this story. So when I was in my first class, I had gotten, and listeners know this story kind of, I had gotten a copy of Kingdom Hearts Birth by Sleep from a friend of mine who had come back from Tokyo. And I was playing that in Japanese, and I accidentally, in retrospect, said, "Oh my," referring to another person in class.
Right, yeah.
And my teacher got very upset with me.
Yeah, you're starting a fight.
Yeah, exactly. So there's definitely words that if you don't have the context, you don't want to go around talking like that to random strangers.
Right, yes. Yeah. And learning with media can get a bit dangerous like that. But it's the same thing if you're learning English. I have students at university who learn English through watching movies, and they'll try and use the catchphrases that they hear in the shows and something. And it will sound very, very weird sometimes when they don't quite get the nuance of how it's used, why it's used in that situation. And sometimes it can appear quite aggressive, you know, using language that shouldn't be used in certain situations.
I've always been thinking about the Omaya phrase. That's one that I also encounter constantly. Fire Emblem Three Houses is one such example where I was baffled to find that the students with an astounding regularity address the teacher, you're playing as a university teacher, as Omae.
Oh, right.
Why is that? Why is it that it's so common to use a phrase or a way to address someone that in day-to-day or daily life would be considered like at least very casual, also slightly rude? How come that it's so popular in video games and in fiction?
Often this type of language is used to add personality. It can be used, for example, to make someone appear very casual, slang. It can add depth to their character. If everyone said, you know, anata wa, anata, or something like that, or if they always use the person's name, it's kind of boring. It's not very interesting, and it doesn't really have any personality behind it. So when you say something like omae, it shows this level of, You are not talking to someone with respect. You are talking either down at someone, or maybe you're angry. Maybe you. There are lots of situations in creative media where you're likely to use language that you wouldn't use in real life, right? And that is for the sake of being interesting. if every media we read was the same as how we talk in normal everyday life, it would be really, really boring. So I think it has a lot to do with that.
One of the cool things that can do, though, especially once you get a little more familiar with the language, is, and I think I'm not going to deign to understand, you know, why any creative person would write anything in any particular way, but I would think that in Japanese media, a lot of times, if you hear a character speak a certain way, it's shorthand for who that character is.
Mm.
Where if you hear somebody using the kind of more familiar or rude language, your brain immediately kind of shifts to, oh, I think this is probably meant to be like a more rough and tumble kind of character, as opposed to a more honorable like knight or something, if you're talking about a fantasy world or something like that. Do you find that you pick up on that as you play games, where you realize like, oh, Ryuji is meant to be this kind of character because he talks like this?
Definitely. Yeah, there are definitely character archetypes. You know, you have the old stoic man who's always the strong, quiet type. You have the kind of nonchalant, don't really care young guy character who speaks in a little bit more slang.
The omae guy. That's the omae guy, basically.
Yeah, the omae guy. You have, obviously, the very polite characters who always speak in very eloquent keigo and very clearly and well-pronounced. And yeah, you have the girl characters who speak in high-pitched voices and with cute little endings and things like that. And it definitely shows the character and what their personality is like through that, yeah. People often say that Japanese isn't as creative as English, for example, the language in itself. But I think these things that we're talking about right now is what helps give that creative depth to the language. That also, when you know Japanese and you understand why this was used in this situation, that also adds a little bit more of a subtle depth to the language itself through the context in which the language is used, right? If you just translate omae, it's a pretty boring you, right? But if you actually look at the context of why they're saying it, you could actually be a little bit more creative with the translation and maybe speak in a little bit more of a rough way or that type of thing. So
I think that's especially something that happens once you get a little bit out of the comfort zone of your native language and open yourself up to understanding things in Japanese without translating it in your head directly. So the omae,
yeah.
You don't, so you can actually acknowledge the distinction between something like anata and omae without having to reduce it to some form of like you.
Yeah, so something that's been coming up a lot lately that I've really been thinking a lot about and I've been seeing is that it's much more important to learn how something is used than how it's translated. And there isn't really too much educational material out there that does that. Like, you don't usually learn something with then a blurb of how it's used. You normally learn something with one word, this is what it means. And that's not you can't do that. Japanese and English don't equal the same thing, right? And so I think it's really useful to be able to get that. And I hope that I can help give some of that through the context of the videos that I make and the explanations that I go through. And I try and do that not one-to-one, but this is how it's used, because I think that's a much more useful thing to learn.
This is maybe a pedestrian example, but I was watching your videos, and in your Persona 5 video, you were explaining sort of the combat options. And what I loved about your explanation was that when you said, this phrase means ready your gun, right? You weren't saying like, this is literally what this means. This is, you're making these preparations, you're getting into this stance. Like, it has all of this context around it that would, it's much more meaningful than just the one-to-one translation of that verb, right?
Yeah, well, because you could just give it the English translation that it has, you know, this is this, this, and this. But then you're actually learning just the translation. You're not necessarily actually learning the Japanese and how it is made up. And I think even as a learner, I really wanted to learn in that way. I remember I used to harass my teachers all the time, like, why does this mean this? Why? And the answer was always because it just is. And I never found that satisfying. I always wanted to find out exactly why. And doing that actually helped me get a stronger connection to the language, because I could put the building blocks together and be like, oh, this is why. One that often comes up a lot with people asking is the nakute wa ikenai combination. Because people learn that the whole thing together, right, means must. And then the thing shortened is just the short version. That's, you know, they learn that it's more polite and less polite. Whereas it would actually be much more useful, I think, if you learn, like, the first part is actually saying, if you don't. And the second part is saying what the result is if you don't do that action. Ikenai means it's not good. So what this means is it's showing that if you don't do something, something bad's going to happen. Therefore, you must do it, right? And that's actually the context behind the expression nakute wa ikenai or nakute wa naranai. If you understand that, then you understand why it gets dropped. Because sometimes you don't need to say what's going to happen in casual conversation. You can just say, oh, I got to do this. Why? You don't need to explain that. That's why you can drop it. I think, like, when you actually, unfortunately, literally translate sometimes, can actually really help you in learning and understanding why it's there and how it's used.
I had a friend of mine in class who was, he was very much thinking the way that you are, where it's like, I just want, just explain to me why this is, right? And I learned a lot from him, because he would stop the class a lot and say, but why is it this? And I remember there was one point where my teacher she had come over for a semester from Tokyo. And so somebody asked, how do you say jump in Japanese? And she said, jumpu suru to omoimasu. Like, oh, I think it's to like jump, like the anglicized jumpu.
Right, right, yeah.
And my friend stopped class and he just went, are you telling me that they didn't have jumping in Japan before the 1800s? You know? And so then that became a whole, well, obviously there's a word that you could use, but if you want to use that phrase, we would probably say, you know, so there's all this explanation behind it. So it's worth doing, I think.
Yeah, it's quite funny with the anti-katakana English group of people. I think I would definitely fall into that group. I don't want to learn English. I want to learn Japanese. But sometimes it is a bit excessive. Like, if you play Metal Gear Solid, you will learn what the Japanese word for elevator is. Whereas a lot of Japanese people don't know. They don't know what elevator is in Japanese. They just know it's right, elevator in katakana.
Well, but now you need to say, since the katakana word is erebeta, now you need to say what the Japanese word is.
Right, so shokoki.
Shokoki.
There you go, shokoki.
Shokoki.
This is why I think it's important to play games in Japanese when you're learning, because, you know, you might get a better feel for, if you were to ask, you know, shokoki wa doko desu ka? Where's the elevator? A Japanese person may say, eh?
Yeah, what are you talking right? about? Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit, yeah, it's very strange.
Right.
So you have this channel, Game Again Go, that we obviously link in the show notes as well. And it's very successful. You've got over 12,000 subscribers at the moment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Approximating 13,000. it must be a whole lot of work to do these videos, because when you browse through your videos that you have, then you've got videos that have, and that I can very much recommend as well, because you are helping me learn as well. And it's like over 4 hours of going through all the grammar or all the verbs or all the kanji for a certain level. That requires a tremendous amount of dedication, doesn't it, to do it that way?
Yeah, and it would have been much easier for me if I just decided to make an educational channel instead of also learning every single example through games, because I have to play the games and find the examples and get the footage and edit it all together and make it look good. And like, for example, right now I'm just finishing the next Persona video, and I've been working on it since New Year's. And I mean, like, nonstop. Like, I haven't. I've actually been starting to feel a little bit sick because I've just been working. I decided to take a break so I was in good health for the interview now. usually I work myself sick. And yeah, I've been working full time for this video, and I'm just about finished now. But it's 2.5 hours long, and I break down 200 pieces of Japanese and go through the whole thing and get a bunch of. Kind of tells a cohesive story as well, so it's quite nice. But yeah, it takes a lot of work.
Well, it shows, I must say. I mean, it's I would say that, you know, my Japanese practice is not as frequent as I'd like it living in the middle of Texas. But watching your videos has been a really great sort of refresher. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, it really. I wish you wouldn't work yourself sick, but I will say that it shows.
Thank you for working yourself sick.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah. I'm a perfectionist, and I'm wanting to make something that I wish existed. So I don't want to make something that's just passable. I want to make something that I'd actually be really happy with. So I really try and do my all. Probably too much, really, for the YouTube format. YouTube doesn't necessarily... I think YouTube is much friendlier to quick and easy content, but I'm not really doing it for that reason, right? I just want to make learning Japanese fun. And I also want to celebrate my love for video games and go through and maybe help other people enjoy learning Japanese, help other people get introduced to some new video games, and mostly just have fun. That's the most important thing. So if that costs my health, then I'll do it.
please don't let it come to that. But at the same time, it's like, I think it's just important to emphasize this sometimes, because we're doing a weekly show, and people probably can imagine that it takes a lot more time to put everything together rather than it takes to just listen to the show. And I think, though, when I look at what you do for your channel, and especially the, let's say, more extensive videos that you're doing, I think this is something that is profoundly valuable, because you're basically building a huge catalog of resources that people can still come back to, and it's still going to be up to date in 5 years to come. You know, it's not going away. And that's why I think it's worth it to rather take the time and not to commit to this fast-paced YouTube algorithm logic, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So hopefully there's a lot of people out there who can find it useful. But even if it's only the 12,000 or so that currently are subscribed, if that was the limit, then I would be completely content and happy with that, because I just want to make something that helps people have fun, learn Japanese. If I were to just magically disappear from the world all of a sudden, I would hope that I left behind something that I'd be happy could help people and, you know, bring some enjoyment. So, but for the health side of things, this year is actually going to be a lot better, because thanks to people supporting me for my efforts, I'm actually going to be organizing next year a little bit better. This year, sorry, a little bit better. I've taken one day off from work. so I now have a little bit more time. Yay.
You're on the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that begs my final question. If you had to start all over again, your entire process of learning Japanese, your entire process of engaging with Japanese video games specifically for the purpose of studying it, what kind of advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, geez.
Classic closure question.
If I could give myself some advice.
Shoot for 2 days off.
Yeah. I would say focus on enjoyment. First and foremost, enjoyment should be the number one thing that you focus on. I know in the beginning, you're going to feel like it's an overwhelming darkness of things you don't know. But every day you put in a little bit of work, that darkness will get clearer and clearer, and you'll be less and less overwhelmed every single day. What's most important is that you enjoy the ride, because this is something that there is no real end to learning a language, right? Especially something as complex and interesting and deep as Japanese. It doesn't just end. I've been doing it for 10 years and I see no end in sight. So rather than focus on doing it as quickly as possible, rather than focus on cramming and trying to do everything as efficient as possible, that's the most fun sucking word out there, just enjoy yourself, right? Because if you keep at it and if you're having fun doing it, you might even make more progress than you even would if you did it the most efficient way possible, because you can't wait to get back into it. You can't wait to keep learning. So just find what you enjoy and try and do it the best you can, and don't be so hard on yourself, really.
You're definitely going to have an easier time sticking with it, because as it goes on, I found that the first couple of months of learning Japanese can be very satisfying because you're learning something new all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you hit something that could be referred to as the plateau, or something where you just don't notice the progress as much anymore,
yeah,
that's when it's really important that you are well-paced and that you are motivated and that you just keep going steadily, even though you might not learn something new every week.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, as long as you keep at it, you're enjoying what you're doing, then... Yeah, don't be so hard on yourself. I know so many people are so hard on themselves, like, oh, I can't do this, or it's too much work, or, you know, they burn out, and just it doesn't have to be that way. You can enjoy the ride, you know.
Well, thank you so very much for the conversation. Of course, dear listeners, you can find Matt on his YouTube channel, Game Gengo, which we link in the show notes, and your Twitter handle, Game Gengo, as well. Thank you so very much, Matt, for coming by.
Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Yes, thank you very much.
And in the meantime, Dan, you and me, we're going to move on and do some side questing. As you know, dear listeners, in our side quests, we dive into stories we find interesting and relevant, or, and maybe that is also an interesting or relevant story, video games and impressions that we have of them, games that we're currently playing. Normally, these things are not really related to our main story, but this week it's a little bit of an exception, because while we had this nice chat with Matt just now, you might have thought, but well, aren't there also quite a lot of games that you can use that specifically teach you a language? And yes, there are indeed. That is the point of our first side quest today, number one, which is a game called Influent. And Tobias Klöss, has played it. He is part of the Studying Pixels team, although mostly works in the background, but joins us today for this particular side quest. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Stefan. Happy to be here.
How you doing? Have you enjoyed some Influent time?
I think they hadn't thought about the name before all these influencer stuff. Some Influent time sounds like I'm sitting on the internet and selling some goods.
Well, it is somewhat of a game app, a way definitely that people can learn languages, and you've tried it out now for a couple of months with the kind support of the developers who provided us with a key for the game. So this is just a brief disclaimer up top. And you tried to get into the motions of learning some Japanese with Influent, right?
Yeah. Actually, I received a key for the Japanese language pack, which lets you play the Japanese version of it, or you can use the Japanese words in the game, because basically it's about a young engineer who developed some kind of device where you can walk around and point on things, and then it's like, oh, this is a pillow. If you aren't... knowing what it's in English, then you learning then the English language, or for me, it was makura, the pillow. I've learned with the game, and the story is he developed this kind of device, and then it was stolen. So he has to prove that it is his own invention, and he is setting up this goal for himself that he wants to learn 300 words to prove that he made this thing. On his own.
So basically, the gamey part of it is a little bit, can I imagine it a little bit like a 3D adventure in which you walk around and click on things, like a point and click?
Yeah, basically, yeah. you are in the flat of Andrew and you're walking around and he's very slow, so he's not running. This is one of the downsides of the game. But you're walking slowly around your flat with some kind of ambience music, which gets annoying as hell in the progress. And you have a little sidekick, a little robot who is flying next to your head and is explaining to you that he locked you in. So it's a total perfect lockdown game where you are in your flat and you have to walk around and point and click at things. Or in the case of the iPad version, which I played, you touch at things and then it says you what it is.
So I can click around on the iPad and then I would click at the table and it would say like teburu or tsukue in Japanese.
Yes, that is one of the versions how you can play the game. It's also possible to have some kind of voice mode where you're hearing a sound and then you have to search for the item, or the item is glowing and then you're walking around and of course you cannot find sounds. So these are little orbs flying around in the room and then you have to click on the orb.
What is the language learning benefit in just clicking on orbs? It seems to me like a fun little game, but there must be some kind of language learning purpose of it.
No, this is one version. So the basic version is to click on items and then to learn, for example, the Japanese word for pillow. Then it's going to say makura and it's saving these words. And after you've collected 10 words, you're able to do it reverse. So you're walking around and searching for the item, which is displayed on the end of the screen.
Well, it sounds generally rather promising, although an important question that comes to my mind is, does this do only vocabulary? Because obviously, like, learning vocabulary is tough, and any kind of means that makes it easier is much appreciated. After all, it's very dire to go to through just like a printed list of vocab and just commit it to memory. So in that way, it seems to be helpful. But does it also tell you about what to do with these words or how to enact them in a grammatical structure?
No, it won't tell you to ask a question about something or to tell somebody else that this is a banana in Japanese. It's not like you basically just play Influent for the end of days, till the end of days, and then it's like, okay, I know Japanese. You are able to walk around and point on things and say their names, but it's not like that you learn the long language. It's more like, as you say, a vocabulary trainer.
So you learn, let's say, 300 most common vocabulary, or let's say nouns in the home.
Yeah, that's basic idea to learn what a book is. And I think a great part of it is that it is connecting the room to the learning of the words, because I know what hon is, for example, that this is a book, because if I think about the book, I'm thinking about the bookshelf, which is next to the bed, where this thing is, which makes this sound.
I guess it seems like an all right tool for very, very beginner stage. So for everyone out there who's like just about to get started learning some very simple Japanese stuff, I think it's, or any kind of language really, right? Because you can learn many more languages.
Yeah, you basically can learn 20 languages, and they're also working on 20 more. So, and there are things like Mandarin, Chinese, Korean, Russian, English, French, Italian, and French is actually for free now on Steam.
I saw the app on the App Store and it said like free download, but then you pay per language basically.
Yeah. You pay like it's €5 in the Steam sale now. And I think on the iPad it was also some kind of $5. It's very cheap. if you compare to something like a Duolingo course, which is like 10 euros for a month?
I don't know. I mean, for me, it's like, it seems neat to do this thing as part of a game, and I can just, you know, maybe while I'm on the train, I can fumble around with it a little bit and learn some nouns. But it also is, as far as I understand it, very limited in its capabilities. It is cheap, but also it is kind. It seems kind of like you get what you pay for, because if you pay for something like, let's say, a language course, or if you pay for such a tool like WaniKani, which is very common for people studying kanji, which teaches you also a lot of nouns, but also all kinds of like very common vocabulary, like thousands of words. And, you know, their grammatical structure, it gives you examples and such things. That is obviously, it's for me, it seems to be much more appealing. However, it's also a lot more expensive. Like a WaniKani lifetime subscription is between $200 and $300.
I think you have to consider the first release of the game. This was in December 2013. And of course, it's now coming to the, or it is released on the iOS devices, on the iPad and on the iPhone. You can play it now on the go, but back then in these days, I don't think there was that much of a lot of alternatives. So now we have all these different tools, and of course there are a lot of kind of online sessions. You can take a Japanese course from your home. There is this possibility to have great language learning games, and I think Influent is one step in the right direction, but it is pretty old and it looks pretty old, and sorry for saying that, but the main character is walking around like some kind of human snail, and I think there would be the opportunity to make a lot of things better, and then I think it would be a really great game.
Okay, there you got it. So Influent, one means for, let's say, very early beginners of learning a language to get into some, it's not immersion, but into learning some proper and important nouns. Thank you for your impressions, Toby. Thanks for coming by. Moving on with number two, PlayStation VR 2 and PlayStation VR 2 Sense Controller, the next generation of VR gaming on PS5. Now, this is a little bit older, this story. I brought it still for a specific reason, and that is, I think this is at least a big chunk of a prediction that I made last year come true, or at least about to come true. So here's what happened. That on January 4th, Sony announced what had long since been rumored, which is the PlayStation VR 2. I think this was a pretty obvious thing because the PlayStation VR was quite a success as a consumer VR headset. It was relatively affordable in comparison to many other headsets out there. It was easy to just, you know, plug it in, calibrate it briefly, and then to use it. But the PlayStation VR does not, as of yet, work natively with the PS5. You require like an adapter that you can get for free, but it's all a little bit clunky and it's not ideal. And that's why it was very much expected that the PlayStation VR 2 would be announced at some point, and that happened now. So what the PSVR 2 prides itself on is high visual fidelity. They're talking 4K HDR and OLED displays. So in the actual headset, you've got an OLED display that you look at, and I find that so delicious and exciting because, I don't know, Dan, you are also like an OLED TV geek, aren't you?
I am, although I don't have one. But
you don't have.
Yeah, but I totally endorse them.
Yeah, I mean, ever since I had the pleasure of looking at an OLED TV, I found it really hard to turn back because it produces this very clear and crisp black. And I hope that it's the same kind of effect that we will see with the PlayStation VR 2. They also detailed, quote, players can expect a display resolution of 2000 times 2040 per eye and smooth frame rates of 90 to 120 hertz, end quote.
Wow.
That's pretty fast, pretty impressive stats. I have something to say on that in just a moment. What I think is also very exciting is that they claim it will have just a one cord setup. So there's one cable that you plug in and you are done. You don't need to set up an external camera anymore, because with the first PlayStation VR, you always had to set up like a PlayStation camera, had to clip it on top of your TV and hope that it doesn't fall down.
Right.
Now with the PlayStation VR 2, that's off the table, because the headset basically tracks itself in space. It tracks itself and the controllers. I'm really curious to see how that would work when it comes to accuracy, but it can't be in any way worse, I could imagine, than a camera that just tracks the glowing lights on the outside of a headset.
I wonder if they're maybe taking cues from the Oculus, the other VR headset that seems to be pretty self-contained. I mean it's definitely doable, but we'll see how many. I imagine there's going to be a period of bug testing for a lot of people getting this.
Certainly.
Yeah.
But at least it would enable you also to play in a relatively bright room. This is a problem in one particular room at the game lab at the university, where we have a PlayStation VR headset, because I don't have one privately at home. But there we've got big windows. And the problem is that when the light shines in, the PlayStation camera fails to track the headset. And this should be gone with the PlayStation VR 2, which would be quite amazing.
That's a problem that you don't anticipate until you see it, that the overexposure of the camera is going to mess with the tracking.
Exactly. But, exactly. Yeah. That's only when you use it, then actually you run into these kinds of problems. Mm. Also, kind of nice, it's going to have an eye tracking feature. I'm curious to see what they're going to do with that, because thus far the headset would only track the movements of the head. But obviously, as human beings, we also have eyes that we move independently of our head movement. And it will have the sensory features of the DualSense controller, as well as 3D audio support, which was quite obvious. They also announced this in combination with a Horizon spin-off game titled Call of the Mountain. Horizon Call of the Mountain. This will be, I suppose, the first showcase game to demonstrate the capabilities of PlayStation VR 2. Now, this was remarkably close to my prediction that I made, because Dan, you and me, we did a prediction episode at the end of last year where we predicted what would happen in 2022, and we would get points in case we're right. And for me, in this case, I would get 2 points if my predictions on PlayStation VR 2 are accurate. And thus far, there are 2 things that I predicted that came true. The first one is it is natively made with the PS5 in mind. Okay, that's a pretty safe bet, I would say. of course they would do that. For which other console?
Yeah.
They also said it's going to have the haptic feedback that we know from the DualSense controllers. While the controllers look completely different, PlayStation VR 2 controllers, they look more like a little bit like gloves that you slip in. Like they have this arching part that goes over your hand, which is not uncommon for contemporary VR controllers. It will have the haptic feedback of the DualSense controller, which was also, I think, relatively obvious. Now, here's one that's a little bit more contentious, I'm going to say, because I predicted that it's going to have a 1080p resolution and 60 frames per second in performance mode. So I was extremely specific with that. Now, they announced they're going to do 4K and they're going to go to 90 to 120 hertz. Okay, I understand, but I think let's see whether that actually will happen in practice. Because my guess is still when they talk about 2040p and when they talk about 120 hertz, I'm not so sure whether this is what will actually be reached. Because there's an 8K logo on the PlayStation 5 box. You know what I mean?
Yes, looking to the distant future.
It's like, yeah. I'm happy when the PS5... I would be happy if the PS5 were able to pull off 4K with 60 frames per second consistently. So I doubt that we're going to see 120 frames with 2040p as a default.
We've talked before about how PlayStation has this track, or Sony has this track record of making the PlayStation systems incredibly advanced, but then game developers won't catch up to it for years and years. And so yeah. I have a feeling that it may be the case that the software is limiting the device, look terrible or make you throw up if you try to go into a higher resolution. So you may still be right.
It might be that. It might be that for games, it would be tough to reach that kind of balance, because obviously the higher the resolution, the harder it is to get a fast and smooth frame rate, right? Because more pictures with the same resolution need to be rendered at such a high pace. So my guess is they're going to have a compromise. It's going to land somewhere in the middle. And maybe you're going to reach the 2040p with 120 hertz when doing some kind of, let's say, maybe interactive experience or some kind of like movie thing that you can watch on this thing. But I doubt that a full-fledged game is going to run at 120 hertz with 2040p in VR.
Pretty impressive if it did right off the bat.
Yeah, we'll it would see. Be pretty impressive. But yep. Two things are still outstanding, and that is the price. I predicted that the price is going to be at $349. So
You didn't take OLED into account, though.
I didn't take OLED into account. But I think they're still going to maintain that low price. That's my guess.
You think so?
I think Sony would not go above the price of a standalone PlayStation 5 console, which is, for the digital version, $400.
Yeah, that would be something else if they did that.
Exactly. It's like the PlayStation is more expensive than the actual console, which nobody can buy still, by the way.
Yeah, but, right.
I think that would be a little bit too daring. So my guess is they're going to still stick with the 349, and they're going to sell it maybe at a loss, the headset itself. But they're going to try and get it in the hands of as many people as possible. So what they can then sell and make money on will be the software, like Horizon Call of the Mountain, for example. Yeah. And what's also unclear yet is when it's going to come out. That's not yet announced. My prediction was 2023. Now that they made the move and went public and announced it in January already, I can fail. My prediction might fail here because it might be that they come out in autumn this year. But there's still a chance there that they'll push it back to 2023.
I still think that you're on the board for at least one point with this, regardless of the rest of it, because that was such a quick turnaround from our guest to their announcement. So, well, I tell you what, this is another side quest altogether. But this the resurgence of VR for the PS5 gets me really hopeful. They might do another handheld, a PS Vita Plus or something.
Oh, you think they're going to do that?
I hope so. I really do, because that PS Vita, we've talked at length about how beautiful a system that was. And if they could capture something like that to go with the PS5, we'll see. I don't know. They're bringing stuff back. We're keeping on with VR, so.
I think you're holding on a thin thread of hope there, because I'm pretty confident that Sony has closed the chapter on handhelds. I think after what they did with the Vita, I think that they just said, okay, let's just leave it to Nintendo.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. But I'm going to live in hope anyway, like a fool.
Yeah, well, maybe some point. Maybe at some point. We never know. Yep. Number three, what have you brought, Dan?
Yes, so it's welcome, everyone, to Dan's Deltarune Corner. I wanted to talk about my experience with Toby Fox's newest endeavor, Deltarune. Recently, Chapter 2 was released. Actually, I say recently, it was a few months ago now.
And free even, right? Both Deltarune chapters are free. He just gives those things away.
He does. He's a wonderful man. I wanted to talk about this because we've talked about Undertale and Toby Fox briefly on air before, and lots just the two of us. But I recently, when I went home for the holidays, my brother Matt said, why don't we play through Deltarune Chapter 1 and 2? Because he had recently played through Chapter 2, and he loved it. And so we sat down, and we did it all in one go. It was maybe 8 hours, just on a weekend. We played through it, and I have to say, Toby Fox understands video games better than anyone else, I think.
Yeah.
He is, those chapters, just to give a brief overview, they are hilarious. The music is incredible. The story is so interesting in a way that both separates itself from Undertale, but also elaborates on a lot of the themes from Undertale, particularly this idea of what we owe to video game characters and what they want outside of our interaction with them. He has such a finger on the pulse of what makes people love video games. It's incredible to me. So I thought that I would just kind of gush about it for a little while, because maybe 3 weeks ago that my brother and I did that, and I've been thinking about it nonstop since then.
I felt exactly the same way. I can't even recall whether I played part two. I think I only played the first installment of Deltarune, but I do remember how much love and how much expert craftsmanship goes into such a piece that he then just butters out like that and is just like, lol, here's my new game, you know, enjoy. If you like, if you don't, then it's also fine, you know?
Yeah.
It's the interesting thing is that as precise as he is with, as you said, having his hand on the pulse of video game culture, as casual he is about the delivery of that, you know?
I think it's the, and I'll fully admit that I'm really, you know, a huge fan of this guy, because I think that it takes a masterful touch to make it seem so effortless. And I know that he jokes about, like, he even puts jokes in the games about the annoying dog, which is his stand-in character, working really tirelessly at a computer that shows up a few times. But I think that if you told me that this was from, realistically, the mind of one person with a lot of help from other people, I would be shocked if I hadn't experienced it myself, because it really is. It's let me put it this way. It's very difficult, in my opinion, to have a game like, I'll use Undertale as an example. A game like Undertale, which so deeply interrogates the idea of morality and what it is that we're getting out of video games, to have that be so deep and yet have the game be so fun and enjoyable is unbelievable to me. Because I've played plenty of games that go into that are kind of more academic or more of like a slog to get through a little bit. Undertale and Deltarune, you don't think about these things until long, you know, you've put the game down, because while you're playing it, you're just enjoying it.
I think that's one of the greatest attributes, when you can make a game that is enjoyable as a game and at the same time highly inspiring, moving, and all of its parts, when it comes, like, from the character designs to the writing to the musical compositions to the actual just feeling of the gameplay of the combat and stuff, is really impressive. And I think, well, you said, on the one hand, you said it's almost unbelievable or hard to believe that it came from the mind of one single person. On the other hand, it is exactly the fact that it comes from one person that makes it so good, because I think, yes, Undertale, and that applies to Deltarune as well, those are games that truly fit into the label of being an auteur's game. Like, this is Toby Fox is like an author, and his vision or his idea of what the game should be just flows through every single part of it, and that's what makes the charm of the game work, I think.
Yes, I 100% agree. I would definitely call him an auteur, and unlike a lot of other auteurs, his work never seems self-indulgent to me. It always seems like there's a definite point that he's making, but he also has a lot of, it seems like he has a lot of fun doing it. And I wanted to share this, because I was reading his Twitter, and there's a character in the second chapter named Spamton, who, he's a bit character, but he's one of these Toby Fox characters that is on screen for minimal amounts of time, but he's the one that stands out.
Yeah.
And Toby Fox recently tweeted about how he just created this character kind of on a lark, and he's so happy that people like him. So there's something charming to me about his approach to people's reactions to his games, because I think he got very overwhelmed with Undertale, and he's expressed since Chapter 2 of Deltarune has come out that he's so pleased that people are enjoying Deltarune on its own terms and not as a sort of shadow of Undertale, which I think a lot of one-hit wonder game developers might worry about. And I don't think he has anything to worry about in that category.
I don't think so either. I mean, it's definitely similar in certain regards. It also has some connections. And I mean, clearly, Deltarune and Undertale are related just via its name. So I think that he's brave enough to draw these deliberate connections. At the same time, there are points, at least in the first chapter that I've played, where it very clearly contradicts what you've learned in Undertale about, you know, how the world works and how you ought to behave in a video game. Very charming and very interesting. And the most important point, I think, that you just mentioned fleetingly, is that he doesn't seem to be self-indulgent. He doesn't seem to take the art that he makes, and it's doubtlessly considered to be art, he doesn't take it too seriously, because that's yes. always when things get a bit obnoxious. When, you know, David Cage, I know.
The best segue on the show.
I know. Very contested figure. But the thing is, David Cage did something way back in, how was it called? Indigo Prophecy in the US, right? Indigo Prophecy. I remember one of the most distinct things I remember about that game, which was terrible in quite some other regards, was that the first thing that happened is that David Cage appeared on the screen and said, like, "Hi, I'm David Cage. I made this game. Now you can try this and that." And you know, you learn the controls by, you know, basically speaking to the creative director of that game. And I think that was an important part that set it apart, that made it clear, like, okay, he presents himself as an auteur, but he's also kind of in the game, and he doesn't take things like all too seriously. Whereas later on, I would say at the latest, starting with Beyond Two Souls, maybe even with Heavy Rain, he took himself so seriously in being like an auteur that afterwards it was just too much. And
it's self-parody at a certain point.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. If you take yourself so seriously, then it's tough. It's tough to come off as credible. It's easier for me to resonate with someone, with the works of Toby Fox, when I know that the person who made this kind of stuff just enjoyed it and played with it just like I'm playing with the game. You know, I think that's a very important part of it.
I think so. And I think that, you know, the fact that David Cage's stand-in for David Cage is David Cage, but Toby Fox's stand-in for Toby Fox is an annoying dog, I think speaks volumes. I think the last thing I want to say about Deltarune, because I could talk about it forever, is that, yes, the first two chapters are free. You can get them on Steam, I believe, and then also on the Switch, and I think pretty much most platforms.
I think so, yeah.
And there's supposed to be, there's going to be up to chapter 7, and the following chapters supposedly are going to be paid for. So I think, I mean, it's a hell of a demo to give out, these first two chapters, really tons of worth in those 8 to 10 hours. And I think that what gets me so excited about his work is that sometimes, and Stefan, I'm sure at some point you feel this, as I get older, I worry that I'm not as invested in games as I was, or I'm not getting the same amount. But then a game like Deltarune comes around and I think about it forever and I just think, oh no, this is still a huge passion of mine.
The passion is still there. That's wonderful. And I hope for you out there it is the same. Your passion may still burn brightly. Thank you so very much for listening to this episode. If you want to support us, then go over to studyingpixels.com/plus, where you can get our Studying Pixels Plus membership. It would also be very helpful if you went over to Apple Podcasts and gave us a 5-star rating. And if you want to reach out, then go to studyingpixels.com/contact. We're looking forward to hear from you, and we'll talk again very, very soon. Bye-bye.
See you then.